Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English day.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach. The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is December 15th, 2018, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400.
If it is sometime after December 15th, 2018, I would really like a call so that you can tell us what's going on in the future. And on that note, we have a caller.
Oh, yeah, cool. Maybe they're calling from tomorrow.
Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Okay, guys. Really enjoy the show.
Thanks.
I have a hypothetical question for you.
Okay.
Not sure what the rule was, but I think the FCC passed a regulation for internet companies that reduced their liability for people posting on their sites. And I don't want to litigate it on the air, but there's been some allegations that a lot of the FANG stock companies are, through their algorithms, are trying to change people's opinions. And Congress is taking interest in that. I know the FANG stocks have been driving the stock market the last couple of years. Let's say, for discussion purposes, if Congress gets involved and changes their status to a newspaper or a news outlet, I guess the liability ruling goes away. What do you think, if that happens, what do you think that effect would have on their stock price? So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's a complicated question. So I don't believe it's the FCC or the SEC that have come out with an opinion on commenters. This is something that is even more complicated than that. It's a hodgepodge of court cases and rulings on those court cases. So the question is, if you have a website, whether that's a newspaper website, a social media website, or a search engine, who's responsible for the content that is put on those sites by third parties? So if somebody puts something really, really nasty on there, or explains how to become the perfect terrorist, or whatever, who's in trouble for that? And we don't know. This is one of those areas that the CEO of Google testified in front of Congress this week. And there were a lot of questions along the lines of, here's a simple one. Why is it that when you Google the word idiot, there are a lot of images of the president, Donald Trump, that pop up? And I can give you the answers because I can give you the answer to that. I mean, it was given by the CEO. It's basically algorithmic, but I can give you the ins and outs of that. Google's algorithm is a popularity contest to some extent. If a lot of people do the same search words, and we all know that a lot of people do the same search words, there's polls of that. What's the most common searched thing in a given state? Well, Google allows that information out there. If you are searching idiot, and then you click on an image of the president, that influences the next search. There's going to be more likelihood of the president's picture being there because it's saying you did the search using that word, and that was the result you wanted because you clicked on it, you went through to it, you didn't continue looking down the list. It's basically a popular, you vote with your clicks. And if enough people are searching idiot and then clicking on the president's picture or writing the word idiot next to the president, then that's what you're going to get. And this is one of those fascinating areas. It sounds like I'm about to change the subject. I'm not. Every year, Splash Data does a reference to the most commonly used passwords. They go through all of the data dumps from the hackers, and they're on the black web or the dark web, and they're digging through to see what is the most common password. And one of the most common passwords that has not been there before, it's shown up as number 23 on the list, is Donald. So we have a polarizing president. There are people on the left wing that absolutely detest him, and there's people on the right wing that absolutely love him. When you get that, you get weird results in algorithms. Just think of it from that perspective. Google's, they're determined to make a profit. This is the full focus of almost any for-profit firm. They want to make a profit, and they want to give people what they ask for. That's how you make a profit with customers. Their customers are people that use their search engine. They also have customers that advertise to those people. So they want their search engine to act in a way that is most appropriate to what they think people want. If you're clicking on things like, and this is interesting because there's data out there on people that click on an image of the president when they do a search for idiot that love the president, but they click on it because they're so upset about it, and that also influences the next search. It's very much like the market.
Well, there's an interesting thing. I just Googled idiot, and the top three pictures that showed up for the president, and the reason is because the word idiot is associated with a picture of the president because the question was raised in Congress in a public hearing.
Why is that when I Google idiot, I get the president?
I get Donald Trump.
So it's Trump, a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And idiot were associated with each other, and all Google does is see if this word is associated with this picture, you're going to get the picture.
Right, and this is – we've got a caller waiting. Please wait for us. We're not ignoring you. A really easy way to think of this is if – and I've used this example for other things in the past, but it's a really good example for this – how someone can influence a marketplace with their words. If you're a food critic and you go to a restaurant and you really love it, and the reason you really love it is that there are no crowds and the staff is very accommodating and the prices are low, and you post that and you've got a good following – well, a lot of people will start going to that restaurant, which means the first thing that you liked about the restaurant just changed. Now it has crowds. The second thing about the restaurant is likely to change unless they hire a lot more staff. Their staff is going to be overworked because there's a lot more people there. And the third thing is likely to change. You liked them because their prices were low. Well, if demand goes up, those prices go up too. Your opinion changes the market. And posting somewhere that if you Google the president or you Google idiot, the president's picture shows up, causes more of the president's pictures to show up when you Google idiot. They are measuring the marketplace with algorithms. And they don't have a team that can directly influence that. They can put caps on it for things like child pornography. Go ahead.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you. The important thing is that you mentioned an allegation that the algorithms were trying to slant people and change people's opinion. By the way, I've seen no evidence of that. The issue is obviously if human beings are involved,
and
the group of human beings who are sorting through and eliminating certain comments on Google,
right.
And that particular group of human beings, for instance, believes that equality and diversity is good. When they see white supremacists writing, have a tendency to be prejudiced against them. On the other hand, if another organization says white supremacy is a really good thing, they're going to have a tendency to be against anyone who sounds socialist.
Right. And just to hit the algorithmic approach one more time. During the presidential election, if you had Googled the word traitor, Hillary Clinton's picture would have popped up. It's not that Google was saying elect President Trump. It's just when people were Googling the word traitor, they wanted to hear about Hillary Clinton.
And I think we have a caller who's been patient.
Yes. So caller on 773-1400, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have little knowledge about this that you're talking about right now, and then I have another question. The section that is being under question is Section 230. It was a law that was written in 1998 under Bill Clinton. It had to do with giving blanket immunity to websites. for removing and changing and whose content is it, so forth and so on.
Right. This is the Communication Decencies Act. Yeah.
Yes, sir. And that has now been moved due to court battles and rulings to cover things that the original law or the intent of the law is no longer there.
Right.
So the Congress is reconsidering redoing 230 to look at these things. Okay. Now, that's just a comment, a question. Do y'all have any knowledge or comments about the new opportunity zones?
Yeah. Anything particular or?
No, just basic knowledge. I know that on capital gains, you can kind of do it like the 1031s, invest in these funds, not pay taxes if you on capital gains or any gain, not just any capital gain, right, with a shorter long term. And as long as that money is invested in opportunity zones, there's some real huge tax advantages there.
Right. We have not touched on this very thoroughly because it gets into an area that can become dangerous. It's new. And anytime you have a new thing, there's already a lot of scamming that's going on this subject. It's becoming on the flag spectrum. People, it's starting to get flagged as a common scam where people say this is a new opportunity zone, you should invest here and you'll save a lot of taxes, when it's not. So the oversight on what is an opportunity zone has not been developed as clearly as I want it to be before we can look at it and clearly say this is covered or this is not. It's an excellent idea. The practice of it is, we'll see. It's a good experiment. In a new opportunity zone, the idea is to innovate and grow in areas that haven't been grown before. There are methods of becoming part of those zones into the future. How long the law is going to be the way it is a big question as well. So I think it's a subject that we need to hit again when we have some more time just to really fill in the details of this.
Let me tell you the thing about opportunity zones. I think we've had this type of law passed before, and they only last as long as Congress leaves the law in place. And this one was passed pretty quickly. It's a new law, and the regulations haven't been written yet. And the regulations, by definition, will be in phenomenal detail, and you'll need to jump through a lot of hoops. And let me tell you why. The fact that a business that you invest in or a housing development you invest in or something is inside the geographic limits of an opportunity zone will obviously attract a corporation to open up an office there so that you can say you're investing in the opportunity zone, even if they do no business in the opportunity zone. So there's going to be some complex rules. And until we see the rules laid out and tested in court, you won't know for sure that you'll get all these tax advantages.
Here's the other end of it. Once it's established, we don't know how long it's going to be around. There's another version of this that was done for real estate development that caused a massive real estate implosion that took down most of the small banks and savings and loans in Texas. So when you get tax credits for investing in certain things, people invest in those things even when the profitability of it goes away. There's a hype that gets built around it. So there's an extra degree of due diligence and investigation that needs to be done to make sure that the new opportunity and the investment that you're doing is one you would make even if that credit doesn't exist, even if you don't get the step up in basis, even if you don't have a permanent exclusion.
There have been several laws, for example, that targeted creating affordable housing in low income areas.
And some of those laws are credited with the beginning of the end for
right.
The Great Recession.
But the point that The beginning of the end?
The beginning of the end that led to the Great Recession.
Okay, okay, it's better. Okay. The point in those laws is that I recently, a little while back, I read a study. These go back to the 1980s and 90s. Is that real estate investments in those areas, generally speaking, lost money. Now, not having capital gains on a loss is not.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was you also, because of the fact that you weren't or you had tax advantages, if you made a gain in that area, you also did not get to write off the loss if you had a loss in that area. That's why I say read the fine print very carefully. So people invested in those real estate projects. Unfortunately, many of them who met all the requirements were trashed or they were poorly built or, I mean, you name the things that could go wrong and they did go wrong.
And part of that is because people were jumping on them as quickly as they could. When people are looking at this time of year, here's two big rushes that I see based on the tax cut, on the tax cut that we had in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. There is a massive move toward divorce. What? People say, what is that? What are you talking about? If somebody's already in the process of getting a divorce, the gas pedal just got pushed really hard because alimony payments are no longer tax deductible starting January 1st. And so that's causing this unexpected rush, although it would have been expected if people had had time to read and understand the bill very well. There's a big change happening on how payments are made to ex-spouses and their taxability. And it's a massively negative one. Whether that's a better thing for taxes or not is kind of an open-ended question. When you've got a lot of money that's, you know, if somebody's saying, hey, I'm about to sell some property and I'm going to get a big tax capital gains hit on this unless I do something special with it, and it's newly available, there's a tendency to act on the fear of the deadline instead of doing the investigation to make sure that what you're buying with that money is still a good investment. And that is why we say we want to spend some more time on this in the future. Anytime the reason for the investment, the sole or major reason for the investment is taxes, you have to approach it with a very, very careful, studious thing. And that's also one of the things that is kind of discouraged in those investment decisions, because taxes have deadlines. And I don't like deadlines when it comes to making a decision on an investment. If you have an investment that's going to be a long-term investment and you're expected to own this investment for 7 to 10 years, which is the concept here behind this law, by the way, but you have 2 weeks to make the decision, go for it. I don't like that.
Well, then there's another aspect to it which indicates that it could get trashed down the road, and you could lose all those wonderful tax breaks. First, it hasn't been tested in court. And secondly, one of the arguments against it that was made by a number of people this last week were that some of the areas that were targeted in the Northeast are undergoing gentrification. And there was some activity like this that happened in New York at one point. And what happened was some real estate developers got very, very wealthy, and some people got to buy apartments at very, very low prices and then not have capital gains on them. And they were bought by wealthy people and sold to wealthy people. And the people in the neighborhood basically got moved out because the price of properties went up because everybody was buying them, and it basically forced people out, the poor people out. And so by the time this impact area tax break was being realized,
it wasn't available for the tax break
it
anymore.
It was no longer, it was an ideal situation in that it converted a geographic area into a relatively high income area, but it did so by moving the poor people into another the poor people into another area. And
anytime the government has to give an incentive to invest in an area that people aren't investing in enough, There's a reason why people aren't investing in it enough. Now, let me take a step back. It can be quite profitable. It can be good for all parties to invest in low-income housing areas.
Yeah.
To have an apartment complex that has relatively low rent can be very profitable and can be good for the tenant and the landlord when done properly. When done improperly, one side or the other gets hurt drastically.
And
that's the danger in a rush of money into this area.
And this is what I would say directly about these tax incentive geographic area investing bills and whenever they come up. Anytime you have a developer, organizer, limited partnership, non-traded REIT, any of the various securities devices that pool people's money to try to invest to get this tax advantage, my experience has been that the money that goes to the developers of these organizations and these entities is phenomenal, and the individual investor is left in the dust and generally loses money over the long term.
Right. My thought on this, my approach when it comes to the education of the listeners on this subject is, if you're thinking about opportunity zone investing, if you have just sold a property or you have just sold a big investment and you have all this extra capital gains.
Well, you can't write it off. You just don't pay the capital gains on the other end.
Right. And here's the deal. You need to make these decisions and do this research before you make the sale, before you get the capital gains, because as soon as you do that, a clock starts ticking. Number two, if you're getting into this, two subset A, you got to know what you're buying. The way to make the best profit in real estate investing is to do it yourself. The way to lose the most money in a real estate investment is to do it yourself as well. So how you do it is much more important than what you're doing here. If you buy low, an opportunity zone, this is a low income area. If you buy a property there and you build that property up, you put some money into it to make it into a nice place to live, and then you rent that out, there is absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be compensated for the energy and the time and the money that you put into it. If instead you give a bunch of money to someone else in the hope that they're going to do the research and they're going to do it, then you need to do your research on that someone else. And it needs to be thorough. You also need to know that these are by definition not liquid investments. It's by definition. These are properties that it takes a long time to sell internally, which means even if you're pooling your money with other people, it may be difficult to get your money out should you need it. So you only use investments that you're not going to need on a short term. You build your reserves up. That's true in any case, but this is more so than like a mutual fund even, because this is an illiquid position and you have an additional danger in a government shift in how they categorize a qualified opportunity zone. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I think you mentioned this in passing, one of the attractions here is if you have a piece of property and you have sold it and or you're going to sell it and you have a high gain, it's going to be a long-term capital gain, but you would rather do a 1031 transfer, which defers the gain.
You've got a timeline on that, too. Usually you have to have it before you have the money in hand. You need to be started in purchase.
You have 180 days to reinvest capital gains in a qualified opportunity fund. Well, here's the problem.
Zone.
Fund.
That's a fund. Yeah.
No, in a qualified opportunity fund that's going to invest in the zone. And the problem is, I was just quickly scrolling through, and I've looked at this in the past, the qualified opportunity funds, and they are real estate promotion funds.
Yeah.
And again, I want to bring this back to the point that, and this is important. Every time I have seen this happen in my experience, long term, the reason you avoided paying the capital gains is because you had losses on the tail end of the operation. I certainly have no way of looking into the future and saying that these qualified opportunity funds are all going to lose money. It's always possible you could get into one that could make money and you have a tremendous tax advantage. You roll over your taxes and then don't have to pay any taxes on the tail end. Wonderful thing. But I have been at this now for over 35 years. I have seen real estate limited partnerships. I've seen REITs. I have seen every kind of pooled investment in design that sound like these qualified opportunity funds. I have seen a lot of people lose a lot of money. Now, I saw some people get some big tax write-offs, and they were thrilled that they didn't make any money at the end, but they didn't pay any taxes on a gain they had someplace else. They're really, really happy until after the fact the law changed with the Tax Reform Act of 86, and the IRS came after them.
There's nothing like a retroactive change. You were doing everything right.
But you weren't, because there was another hidden law off to the side that says if your primary – and that law, by the way, is still in the books. If your primary reason for investing in something is the avoidance of taxes, then you pay full taxes plus penalties on it. And the literature, the advertising literature for the real estate limited partnerships in these impact areas back in the 1980s and 90s, specifically cited the tax advantages as a primary reason for investment. And there is still a law in the book someplace, and there's still IRS rules that says if your primary reason for investing in something is to lose money, get a tax advantage, you, by definition, pay full taxes on it and penalties. And that is, I know that sounds really goofy. It's just one of those things where I would approach this with a great deal of caution, recognizing that you could lose everything you invested. You can literally lose everything you invest in these things.
There's a danger there, and it's a danger in any investment. So I think we need to spend another episode on this subject, because it's possible to set up your own fund. It's possible to set up your own partnership or corporation to act as the fund. It's possible for people who have absolutely zero experience in real estate or in any of this area doing the same thing and that are really good marketers. So that's the thing. When we hear about the scams, people say, hey, I've got this qualified opportunity fund, but then they take your money and invest it somewhere else. That means you don't get the tax benefit. You get the opposite of the tax benefit. You get penalties. You get interest. There are real issues to be looked at here. There's also an opportunity to be looked at here. And the idea here is if you're invested in these real estate for long enough period of time, you get no capital gains taxes on the money that you transferred over. And possibly no capital gains taxes on the gains that you have in those investments, if it's held long enough. You're talking about 15 plus years now.
Right.
But the concept here is approach it carefully, just like any other investment. Don't have some kind of money burning a hole in your pocket and make a decision based on that. You do it the way you make any other investment decision. Don't get overly enthusiastic. Do your research. Make sure that the people that you're doing business with are trustworthy. I mean, it's basically the same things that your mom would say about anything when you were a kid. So keep that in mind with this. And we've got a whole bunch of other good stuff to talk about.
We also probably have commercials we'd like to play.
Yeah, we can play some commercials now.
We can come back and talk about some of the other stuff.
We've got oil to talk about. I wanted to talk about Apple's expansion plans. I want to talk about, there's a lot of good stuff. The government shutdown, possibly. Let's see. We already talked about China's economy slowing, but we can, we'll have lots to talk about when we come back. Do you have some subjects you wanted to talk about?
Sure,
as well?
I do. I absolutely do.
Okay. So if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side of this these commercials with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number to call in here has not changed. It is 254-773-1400. If to say is day, what about it? If today is December 15th, my tang gets tungled today. Where you are, and we have about 20 minutes left, and we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, Mr. Jeff and Jake McClure. I'm just a listener out here, and I listen to y'all every weekend, and I just want to thank you for your service to the community. And I feel sometimes when I call in, you know, it's a stupid question, but y'all make it interesting and educational for me to understand it. And I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be leaving town. And I thank you for, you know, the exchange in money, because I didn't know about how much you carry and what you need to ask and tell people. And while I got you on the air, I just want to briefly say God bless you, sir. And I wish you and your family a good Merry Christmas and a very good New Year to come. And you take care of yourself, and whatever life y'all both have, may you live it in peace. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that. And Merry Christmas to you, too.
Very much. Merry Christmas.
Hey, while we're at it, on Netflix last night, I saw an excellent production. I guess you'd call it a movie.
I don't know what I would call it.
The Man Who Invented Christmas.
Oh, yeah. I have that listed on it my to-watch thing.
It's
about the guy that...
It's about Charles Dickens and his writing of A Christmas Carol. And I checked out, I Googled it afterwards and checked it out. It's apparently, although obviously dramatized, a pretty accurate description of his circumstances and how quickly he wrote it and his personality. It is endearing, and it's not very often at the end of a Netflix production that I have tears in my eyes, but it, on this one, it was really well done in every aspect of the way they did it, and we were looking for a new Christmas movie to watch. That was a good Christmas movie.
Fantastic.
All right.
Well, keep that in mind. I wanted to talk about oil.
Well, let me talk about, I want to hit something in here as a precaution.
Okay, let's do it.
There's an article that came out, let's see, where did I get this article from? From Financial Advisor, which is a good one. Why are so many universal life policies failing?
That's funny. I have that article sitting right here, too.
Oh, well, good. Well, folks, a universal life comes in various forms, and sometimes it's called indexed, and sometimes it's called just universal life, and sometimes it's called lots of things. But
sometimes
the bottom line to it.
Variable universal life. Sometimes it's basically any whole life insurance that has a variable payment that you give it over time.
And not like regular whole life where you have a fixed interest rate and a fixed payment that you make. Universal life, you can choose what you pay, and the company then either invests the money in securities, which is variable universal life, or sets a rate each year that they will pay you, with the underlying cost of insurance rates also adjustable by the company. And the key to universal life is you've got to monitor it, and you've got to understand compound rates of return, and you've got to understand that your insurance rates go up internally as you get older. And if you have got loans, or you have failed to make your planned premium payments, in many cases there's a planned premium payment that if you make it consistently forever, they will guarantee that the thing will not fail.
Even if the money inside it dries up and goes away.
But if you messed up that and you didn't make your planned premium payments every month and you've just forgotten about it, or if you've been making the premium payments all along but they weren't quite as high as the planned premium payment, that's a quotation marks around that, this thing could be dying on you. And when they finally announce that you need to pay them several $1,000 immediately, and then maybe $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 a month if you want to keep your life insurance in force, it can be a real shock, because in many cases people retired at that point. They do require your attention.
and they can be, they can blow up and die on you very quickly. And above all, and I've run into this, and so has Jake, people have said, well, why don't I just not make payments for a while, and then when it runs low on money, I'll start making payments again. Well, the problem is, when it runs low on money, the amount of money you have to pay to keep that thing in force, in many cases, is more than you're going to be able or willing to pay, because you have basically been in a position where you're now older, your life insurance rates are higher. So these things bear careful watching, and there's, a lot of people are losing them.
Right. There's another danger here, and this is one that, that we've also both seen. When someone is using the investment part of their universal life, they're taking that money out as their retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of advertisements out there. There's that whole bank on yourself movement
right.
out there that's basically saying, put all your money in life insurance and then live your retirement on the money in the life insurance. There's some major problems here. Number one, as time goes on and you're pulling more money out and your cost of insurance goes up.
Because you're older.
It's, for some reason, they think you're more likely to die the older you get. It's one of those weird things, you know. It's mathematical, I guess. I don't know where they get that. But
it's actually actuarial.
Right. So this, the actuarials, for good reason, are saying...
It's actually actuarial. I like that.
Yeah. You have a greater risk of death as you get older. If you're pulling money out of there and you're doing it the way a lot of people are doing it, through loans from yourself... Because you don't have to pay taxes on the gains on those loans. They have all these great concepts around them. You get into an extremely dangerous situation if you've come close to depleting that life insurance and you don't have enough money in there.
It's not depleting the life insurance, depleting the cash value.
The cash value of the life insurance. You don't have enough money in there to continue to make the payments. You've been using it as your retirement income. Now you have to turn around and start making payments, or the life insurance policy dies.
It lapses.
When it lapses, all those loans that you took out over all those years get treated as a one-time withdrawal, and you're taxed on any gain that you have in there. And you say, what do you mean, gain? I don't have any money left. Well, in essence,
you took it out.
And so there is a... minefield out there. The number one primary, let me say, the pinnacle absolute reason for life insurance is to have insurance on your life, and not retirement, not those other things. There's some benefits that you can get from life insurance in doing that, but you better approach that carefully, or the dangers may be a lot more expensive than you expect.
Now let me say the backside of this, the good news. If you max funded these things to the maximum amount allowed by law for years and years until you just couldn't put any more money in legally,
you're probably in great shape.
You're probably in a position where you can take the money out. But that would indicate you put a lot of money in these things and you were continually bumping up against the upper limit on the amount you could put in, and you didn't take any out during those, no lump sums out during those periods of time. That's why I say they are complex. The guy or gal who sold them to you many, many years ago has moved on, and the statute of limitations has moved on.
So don't think
you can recover it if they told you you can. Matter of fact,
most people that sell these things don't understand how they work.
And several insurance companies at various times have been banned for periods of times in the state of Texas, Prudential being one of them, for selling universal life insurance, telling people this is the rate of return that you'll get, or at least strongly suggesting to them. Back when interest rates were high in the 1980s and 90s, and now when they're running out of money, the insurance company comes back and says, you either need to put a whole lot of more, they haven't taken any money out, they've been making their payments, but the insurance company comes and says, you either need to put several thousand dollars a month in this thing for the indefinite future, or you lose your life insurance. And this isn't a pretty picture, but it does occur.
Yeah, and
so you just need to be, you need to look at these things and be aware how they work,
they
aware
have,
how compound interest works and how mortality tables
right.
work.
Universal life has a very good place in the financial product toolbox, but is not a tool for everybody.
And it's technical. It requires a lot of knowledge to maintain the thing over the years. And the salesperson who sold it to you doesn't get paid to do that. You basically have to take it on yourself to do it. Right. They are sophisticated devices.
They are. And just because they don't understand how they work isn't – that's not a problem in itself. People that sell you your computer don't understand how they work. They don't know how a transistor works on many occasions. They know how it works by you push that button right there.
And I got one more here. I've had some people contact me about whether they should have long-term care insurance.
Okay. Let's go to that one then.
One of the problems that GE is facing financially right now is they have got a block of long-term care insurance that they are losing money hand over fist on.
Yeah. One of the weeks you were gone at a star party, I spent a pretty good period of time on this. So
okay.
I
just want to mention in passing, the problem with long-term care insurance is the company has to make an estimate about how long you live, and people who take out long-term care insurance who can afford to pay for it, generally tend to live a lot longer than the actuaries thought, which means that the companies are one at a time going under. And when they go under, that kind of insurance is in many cases not covered by the state insurance guarantee fund, and you just basically lost your money.
Yeah, and the real issue here, the deep underlying problem in the actuarial data, is that long-term care insurance, and I don't have all the research that I had for that prior episode in front of me right now, but about 90% of the people that buy long-term care insurance wind up using the long-term care insurance.
And they expected only about a third of them.
Right. And in life insurance, for instance, only about a third of the people that buy life insurance actually wind up dying while they own the life insurance.
You mean if you buy life insurance, you have a 67% probability of never dying?
Wow! they usually cancel the policy before they die. And that's not the case when people are talking about long-term care insurance. They tend to hang on to that policy and then use it more like a health insurance policy than like a life insurance policy. And the likelihood of needing long-term care is pretty high. So when you take a high likelihood and 90% of the people actually start using it, it's not good for the insurance companies, which means there are a lot of insurance companies in the long-term care area that are basically just not selling it anymore because it's too dangerous for them.
You had something you wanted to hit on oil, and
yes,
we're running out of time.
Yeah. Big thing is that year over year, Baker Hughes, which is GE, you just mentioned them, so they do a rig count. It's a rigged rig count. This rigged count is very rigged. We're up in the United States 141 rigs over what we were last year. That is a rig count of 1,071. There's only 1,071 in all of the United States in the rig counts. And that says something in itself, that we don't have millions of oil wells. We have just over 1,000 rigs and 141 new ones over last year. Now, this month, we're down 4. And the month before that, we were down 6 because prices have been coming down. And they're taking rigs offline because the prices are coming down. But we're still at a point where we're producing more oil, even with 10 less than we had 2 months ago. We're producing more oil right now than we ever have in the history of the United States.
There's a point here that if you're rig counting, that's important to understand, and that is 10 years ago, a rig drilled a hole in the ground. Now, a rig may be drilling 10 holes in the ground.
That's right. That's
so right. So things have changed a lot with fracking and horizontal drilling. So one rig can be set up and literally drill 10 oil wells, whereas 10 or 20 years ago, we would have had to have 10 rigs drilling 10 oil wells.
Right. And this is another piece here. I would just use the U.S. numbers. They also do a count on international oil wells, international rigs, as well as Canadian. I guess U.S., Canada, and then there's other places. That's how they group it.
Is that the way the world is? Is U.S.,
yeah.
Canada,
oh, yeah,
and then
absolutely.
Other?
All right. And the number of rigs in Canada right now from a year ago is down 49. And the reason is because their oil is a lot harder to refine. It's not as nice. It's, as they call it in the industry, it's not as sweet. Though I would hate to be the taste tester. That's just not that doesn't look
well. You could
like,
be a chemist.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's not. I mean, the word sweet is used. It's a little.
Well, I was
taste buds involved.
I saw some sweet oil, and I looked at it and was quite impressed with it.
Then
you can see through it.
International rig count. This lets you know where we are in the world. The international rig count is up about 49 from a year ago, but it's down 26 from last month. That says something big there. Mm. But I just said the total rig count in the United States is 1,071. The total rig count internationally is 991.
Outside of the United States.
Outside the United States and Canada. So that doesn't mean that they have less oil. It doesn't mean a lot of, because we're talking about Saudi Arabia with some of that stuff, and they basically stick a straw on the ground, and that's how they can tell if it's sweet. it doesn't cost much to have an oil well in Saudi Arabia. But in the United States, what we're seeing is that rig counts are down for the month in North Dakota, in the Denver area. They're up for Oklahoma and for Texas. Big up in the last month. So even with prices coming down, it is profitable at $47 a barrel to make new wells in the Permian area of Texas. So that's a big thing. It means that the prices can keep coming down, and it's still going to be profitable to put in new rigs in Texas.
I wanted to kind of, as we come to the end of the hour, I wanted to kind of sum things up. Current economic indicators, the current ones and lagging ones, particularly the lagging ones, are indicating the economy is on a roll. We're in a boom. Things are going exceptionally well, which, by the way, turns around and puts the pressure on the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates to keep inflation from eating us alive, which leads me over to the leading economic indicators. They're still positive, which means that typically that means we have six months to a year. The chances of having a recession in that time period are extremely low. The long-term leading indicators, and one of the prime leading indicators, by the way, is the housing prices, and they're starting to flatten out and start down. Housing sales are down in many metropolitan areas. We're seeing a lot of indications longer term. These are not our certainties. These are the ones that are before the leading economic indicators even, that tell us that 2019 is going to be a bumpy year. The gross domestic product for 2018 is probably going to come in around 3% for the whole year. Next year will be down in the twos. And by the end of next year, literally all the economic forecasters are saying we're in the ones again. And there's a 30% chance, based on the survey, of a recession next year, which is towards the end of the year. But then it goes up pretty fast in 2020 to a better than 50% chance of a recession.
So keep planning, plan well. Recessions happen. I'm going to end the hour with a very clear thing on the security world. If your password is 123456, you share that password as the most common password. Change it. If your password is password, that's the second most common. It's been the most and second most used password for decades. It's not that brilliant. And the next one's 123456789, 123456789, 111111. If your passwords are easy on a keyboard, change them, because if you don't, someone else will. All right, we're out of time for this week. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend and real-life people during the week.
254-947-1111.
And you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. Email us, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Listen to recordings of this episode and many others. Until next